Part 1. The Experiment. Chapter 1. The Worst Breathers in the Animal Kingdom. The patient arrived, pale and torpid, at 9:32 a.m. Male, middle-aged, 175 pounds. Talkative and friendly, but visibly anxious. Pain? None. Fatigue? A little. Level of anxiety? Moderate. Fears about progression of future symptoms, high. Patient reported that he was raised in a modern suburban environment, bottle-fed at 6 months, and weaned onto jarred commercial foods. The lack of chewing associated with this diet stunted bone development in his dental arches and sinus cavities, leading to chronic nasal congestion. By age 15, patient was subsisting on even softer, highly processed foods, mostly white bread, sweetened juices, canned vegetables, steakums, Velveeta sandwiches, microwave taquitos, Hostess snowballs, and Reggie bars. His mouth had become so underdeveloped it could not accommodate 32 permanent teeth. Incisors and canines grew in crooked. He required extractions, braces, retainers, and headgear. 3 years of orthodontics made his small mouth even smaller, so his tongue no longer properly fit between his teeth. When he stuck it out, which he did often, visible imprints laced its sides, a precursor to snoring. At 17, 4 impacted wisdom teeth were removed, which further decreased the size of his mouth while increasing his chances of developing sleep apnea. As he aged into his 20s and 30s, his breathing became more labored and dysfunctional, and his airways became more obstructed. His face would continue a vertical growth pattern that led to sagging eyes, doughy cheeks, and a sloping forehead. This atrophied, underdeveloped mouth, throat, and skull, unfortunately, belongs to me. I'm lying on the examination chair of the Stanford Otolaryngology Center. I'm looking at myself, looking into myself. For the past several minutes, Dr. Jayankar Nayak has been gingerly coaxing an endoscope camera through my nose. He's gone so deep into my head that he's come out the other side, into my throat. "Say E," he says. Nayak has a halo of black hair, square glasses, and a white coat, but I'm not looking at his clothes or his face. I'm wearing a pair of video goggles that are streaming a live feed of the journey through the rolling dunes, marshes, and stalactites inside my severely damaged sinuses. I'm trying not to cough or choke or gag as the endoscope squirms a little further down. "Say E," Nayak repeats. I say it and watch as the soft tissue around my larynx opens and closes like a stop-motion Georgia O'Keeffe flower. This isn't a pleasure cruise. 25 sextillion molecules take the same voyage 18 times a minute, 25,000 times a day. I've come here to see, feel, and learn where all this air is supposed to enter our bodies. I've come to say goodbye to my nose for the next 10 days. For the past century, the prevailing belief in Western medicine was that the nose was more or less an ancillary organ. We should breathe out of it if we can, but if not, no problem. That's what the mouth is for. Many doctors, researchers, and scientists still support this position. There are 27 departments at the National Institutes of Health devoted to lungs, eyes, and ears, and so on. The nose and sinuses aren't represented in any of them. Nayak finds this absurd. He is the chief of rhinology research at Stanford. He heads a renowned laboratory focused entirely on understanding the hidden power of the nose. He's found that those dunes, stalactites, and marshes inside the human head orchestrate a multitude of functions. Vital functions. "Those structures are in there for a reason," he told me earlier. Nayak has a special reverence for the nose, which he believes is greatly underappreciated, which is why he's so interested to see what happens to a body that functions without one, which is what has brought me here. Starting today, I'll spend the next 250,000 breaths with silicone plugs blocking my nostrils to stop even the faintest amount of air from entering or exiting my nose. I'll breathe only through my mouth, a heinous experiment that will be exhausting and miserable, but has a clear point. 40% of today's population suffers from chronic nasal obstruction, and around half of us are habitual mouth breathers, with females and children suffering the most. The causes are many: dry air to stress, inflammation to allergies, pollution to pharmaceuticals. But much of the blame, I'll soon learn, can be placed on the ever-shrinking real estate in the front of the human skull. When mouths don't grow wide enough, the roof tends to rise up instead of out, forming what's called a V-shaped palate. The upward growth impedes the development of the nasal cavity, shrinking it and disrupting the delicate structures in the nose. Overall, humans have the sad distinction of being the most plugged-up species on Earth. I should know. Before probing my nasal cavities, NIAC took an X-ray of my head, which provided a deli-slicer view of every nook and cranny. "You've got some stuff," he said. Not only did I have that V-shaped palate, I also had severe obstruction to my left nostril caused by a severely deviated septum. My sinuses were also riddled with deformities called concha bullosa. "Super uncommon," said NIAC. It was a phrase nobody wants to hear from a doctor. In fact, my airways were such a mess that NIAC was amazed I hadn't suffered from even more of the infections and respiratory problems I'd known as a kid. But he was reasonably certain I could expect some degree of serious breathing problems in the future. Over the next 10 days of forced mouth breathing, I'll be putting myself into a kind of mucusy crystal ball, amplifying and hastening the deleterious effects on my breathing, which will be getting worse the older I get. I'll be lulling myself into a state it already knows, that half the population knows, only multiplying it many times. "Okay, steady," NIAC says. He grabs a steel needle with a wire brush at the end of it. It's about the size of a Q-tip. I'm thinking, he's not going to be putting that thing up my nose. A few seconds later, he does just that. I watch through the video goggles as NIAC maneuvers the brush deeper. He keeps sliding until it's no longer up my nose, no longer playing around with my nasal hair, but wiggling inside of my head a few inches deep. "Steady, steady," he says. When the nasal cavity gets congested, airflow decreases and bacteria flourish. This leads to infections and colds. Congestion begets congestion, which gives us no other option but to breathe through the mouth. Nobody knows how soon this damage occurs. Nobody knows how quickly bacteria accumulate in a plugged-up nasal cavity. NIAC needs to grab a culture of my deep tissue to find out. I wince as I watch him twist the brush deeper still, then spin it, skimming off a layer of gunk. The nerves this far up the nose are designed to feel the subtle flow of air and slight modulations in temperature, not steel brushes. Even though he's dabbed anesthetic in there, I can still feel it. My brain has a hard time knowing how to react. It's difficult to explain, but it feels as if someone's needling a conjoined twin that exists somewhere outside of my body. "The things you never thought you'd be doing in your life," NIAC laughs, putting the bleeding tip of the brush in the test tube. He'll compare this sample with another 10 days from now and see how nasal obstruction affects bacterial growth. He shakes the tube, hands it to his assistant, and politely asks me to make room for the next patient. Patient number 2 is leaning against the window and snapping photos with his phone. He's 49 years old, deeply tanned, with white hair and smurf blue eyes. He's wearing spotless beige jeans and leather loafers without socks. His name is Anders Olsen, and he's flown 5,000 miles from Stockholm, Sweden. Along with me, he's ponied up more than $6,000 to join this experiment. I'd interviewed Olsen several months ago after coming across his website. It had all the red flags of flakiness. Stock images of blonde women striking hero poses on mountaintops, neon colors, and frantic use of exclamation marks. But Olsen wasn't some fringe character. He'd spent a decade collecting and conducting serious scientific research. He'd written dozens of posts and self-published a book explaining breathing from the subatomic level on up, all annotated with hundreds of references. He'd also become one of Scandinavia's most respected and popular therapists, helping to heal thousands of patients through the subtle power of healthy breathing. When I mentioned during one of our Skype conversations that I would be mouth breathing for 10 days during an experiment, he cringed. When I asked if he wanted to join in, he refused. "I do not want to," he declared, "but I am curious." Now, months later, Olsen plops his jet-lagged body onto the examination chair, puts on the video glasses, inhales one last nasal breath for the next 240 hours. Beside him, NIAC twirls the steel endoscope the way a heavy metal drummer handles a drumstick. Okay, lean your head back, says Nyack, a twist of the wrist, a crane of the neck, and he goes deep. The experiment is set up in two phases. Phase one consists of plugging our noses and attempting to live our everyday lives. We'll eat, exercise, and sleep as usual, only we'll do it while breathing only through our mouths. In phase two, we'll eat, drink, and exercise and sleep just as we did, but we'll switch the pathway to our noses and practice a number of breathing techniques throughout the day. Between phases, we'll return to Stanford and repeat all the tests we've just taken. Blood gases, inflammatory markers, hormone levels, smell, pulmonary function, and more. Nyack will compare the data and see what, if anything, changed in our brains and bodies as we shifted our style of breathing. I've gotten a fair share of warnings from friends when I told them about the experiment. Don't do it, they said. But most people just shrugged. I haven't breathed through my nose in a decade, said a friend who had suffered allergies most of his life. Everyone else said the equivalent of, what's the big deal? Breathing is breathing. Is it? Olson and I will spend the next 20 days finding out. A while back, some 4 billion years ago, our earliest ancestors appeared on some rocks. We were small then, a microscopic ball of sludge, and we were hungry. We needed energy to live and proliferate, so we found a way to eat air. The atmosphere was mostly carbon dioxide, not the best fuel, but it worked well enough. These early versions of us learned to take this gas in, break it down, and spit out what was left, oxygen. For the next billion years, this primordial goo kept doing this, eating more gas, making more sludge, and excreting more oxygen. Then, around 2.5 billion years ago, there was enough oxygen waste in the atmosphere that a scavenger version of us emerged to make use of it. It learned to gulp in all that leftover oxygen and excrete carbon dioxide. This was the first cycle of aerobic life. Oxygen, it turned out, produced 16 times more energy than carbon dioxide. Aerobic life forms used this boost to evolve, to leave the sludge-covered rocks behind and grow larger and more complex. They crawled up to land, dove deep into the sea, and flew into the air. They became plants, trees, birds, bees, and the earliest mammals. These mammals grew noses to warm and purify air, throats to guide it into lungs, and a network of sacs that would remove oxygen from the atmosphere and transfer it into the blood. The aerobic cells that once clung to swampy rocks so many eons ago now made up the tissues in mammalian bodies. These cells took oxygen from our blood and returned carbon dioxide, which traveled through our veins, through the lungs, and back out into the world. This was the process of breathing. The ability to breathe so efficiently in a wide variety of ways, consciously and unconsciously, fast, slow, and not at all, allowed our ancient ancestors to catch prey, escape predators, and get a foothold on Earth. It was all going so well until about 1.5 million years ago when the pathways through which we took in and exhaled air began to shift and fissure. It was a shift that, much later in history, would affect the breathing of every person now living. I'd been feeling these cracks for much of my life, and chances are you have too. Snoring, some degree of wheezing, maybe asthma, allergies, and all the rest. I'd always thought that they were a normal part of being human. Nearly everyone I knew suffered from one problem or another. But I came to learn that these problems didn't randomly develop. Something caused them, and the answers could be found in a common and homely trait. A few months before the Stanford experiment, I flew to Philadelphia to visit Dr. Mariana Evans, an orthodontist and dental researcher who spent the last several years looking into the mouths of human skulls. We were standing in the basement of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, surrounded by several hundred ancient specimens. Each was engraved with letters and numbers and stamped with its race. There were Brazilian prostitutes, Arab slaves, and Persian prisoners. The most famous specimen, I was told, came from an Irish prisoner who'd been hanged in 1824 for killing and eating his fellow convicts. The skulls range from 200 to thousands of years old. They were part of the Morton Collection, named after a racist scientist named Samuel Morton, who starting in the 1830s collected skeletons in a failed attempt to prove the superiority of the Caucasian race. The only positive outcome of Morton's work was that the skulls he spent so many years gathering now provide a snapshot of how people used to look and how they used to breathe. Where Morton claimed to see inferior races and genetic degradation, Evans and her colleagues discovered perfection. To demonstrate what she meant, she walked over to a cabinet and retrieved a skull marked Parsi for Persian. She wiped bone dust on the sleeve of her cashmere sweater and ran a neatly trimmed fingernail along its jaw and face. "These are twice as large as they are today," she said in a Ukrainian accent. She was pointing at the nasal apertures, the two holes that connect to the back of the throat. She turned the skull around so that it was staring at us. "So wide and pronounced," she said approvingly. Evans and her colleague, Dr. Kevin Boyd, a Chicago-based pediatric dentist, had spent the last 4 years x-raying more than 100 skulls from the Morton Collection and measuring the angles from the top of the ear to the nose and from the forehead to the chin. These measurements, called the Frankfurt plane and the end perpendicular, show the symmetry of each specimen, how well proportioned the mouth was relative to the face, the nose to the palate, and, to a large extent, how well the people who owned these skulls might have breathed. Every one of the ancient skulls was identical to that Parsi example. They all had enormous forward-facing jaws. They had expansive sinus cavities and broad mouths. And bizarrely, even though none of these ancient people had ever flossed or brushed or saw a dentist, they all had straight teeth. These people very likely never snored or had sleep apnea or sinusitis or many of the other chronic respiratory problems that affect modern populations. They did not because they could not. Their mouths were far too large and their airways too wide for anything to block them. They breathed easy. Nearly all ancient humans shared this forward structure, not just in the Morton Collection, but everywhere around the world. This remained true from the time when Homo sapiens first appeared on Earth 300,000 years ago to just a few hundred years ago. Evans and Boyd then compared the ancient specimens to modern skulls of their own patients and others. Every modern skull had the opposite growth pattern, meaning the angles of the Frankfurt plane and end perpendicular were reversed. Chins had recessed behind foreheads, jaws were slumped, sinuses shrunken. All the modern skulls showed some degree of crooked teeth. Of the 5,400 different species of mammals on the planet, humans are now the only ones to routinely have misaligned jaws, overbites, underbites, and snaggled teeth, a condition called malocclusion. To Evans, this raises a fundamental question. "Why would we evolve to make ourselves sick?" she asked. She put the Parsi skull back in the cabinet and took out another labeled Saccard. Its perfect facial form was a mirror of the others. She explained that evolution doesn't always mean progress. It means change, and life can change for better or for worse. Today, the human body is changing in ways that have nothing to do with survival of the fittest. Instead, we're adopting and passing down traits that are detrimental to our health. This concept, called disevolution, was made popular by Harvard biologist Daniel Lieberman, and it explains why our backs ache, feet hurt, and bones are growing more brittle. Disevolution also helps explain why we're breathing so poorly. To understand how all this happened and why, Evans told me we need to go back in time, way back to before Homo sapiens were even sapiens. What strange creatures we were, standing in the tall grass of the savanna, all gangly-armed and pointy-elbowed, gazing out into the wide, wild world. As the breeze swayed the grass, our nostrils, the size of gumdrops, flexed vertically above our chinless mouths, picking up whatever scents wafted in. The time was about 1.7 million years ago, and the first human ancestor, Homo habilis, was roaming the eastern shores of Africa. We'd long since left the trees, learned to walk on our legs, and trained ourselves to use the small finger on the inside of our hands. to turn it upside down into an opposable thumb. We used these digits to grab things, to pull plants and roots and grasses from the ground, and to build hunting tools from stone that were sharp enough to carve tongues out of antelope and strip meat from the bone. Eating this raw diet took a lot of time and energy, so we gathered stones and bashed prey against rocks. This spared us some of the effort of digesting and chewing, which saved energy. We used this extra energy to grow a larger brain. Around 800,000 years ago, we began processing food and fire, which released an additional amount of calories. Our large intestines, which help break down raw foods, shrank considerably under this new diet, and that change alone saved even more energy. These more modern ancestors, Homo erectus, used it to grow an even bigger brain, an astounding 50% larger than the Habilis. We began to look less like apes and more like people. If you could take a Homo erectus, dress him up in a Brooks Brothers suit, and put him on a subway, he probably wouldn't draw a second glance. These ancestors were genetically similar enough to possibly have had our children. The innovation of mashing and cooking food, however, had consequences. The quickly growing brain needed space to stretch out, and it took it from the front of our faces. Over time, the muscles at the center of the face loosened, and bones in the jaw weakened and grew thinner. The face shortened and the mouth shrank, leaving behind a bony protuberance that replaced the squashed snout. This new feature was ours alone and distinguished us from other primates, the protruding nose. The problem was the smaller, vertically positioned nose was less efficient at filtering air, and it exposed us to more pathogens and bacteria. The smaller sinuses and mouth also reduced the space in our throats. The more we cooked, the more soft, calorie-rich food we consumed, the larger our brains grew, and the tighter our airways became. Homo sapiens first emerged on the African savanna around 300,000 years ago. We were among a coterie of other human species. Homo heidelbergensis, a robust creature who built shelters and hunted game in what is now Europe, Neanderthals with their massive noses and stunted limbs, who learned to make clothes and flourish in frigid environments. And then there was the Homo naledi, a throwback to early ancestors with tiny brains, flared hips, spindly arms that hung down from squat bodies. What a sight it must have been, these ragtag species all gathered around a blazing campfire at night, a Star Wars cantina of early humanity. Together sipping river water from palm cups, picking grubs from each other's hair, comparing the ridges of their brows, and scampering off behind the boulders to have interspecies sex beneath the glow of starlight. Then, no more. The big-nosed Neanderthals, the scrawny Naledi, the thick-necked Heidelbergensis were all killed off by disease, weather, each other, or laziness, or something else. There was only one human left in the long family tree. Us. In colder climates, our nose would grow narrower and longer to more efficiently heat up air before it entered our lungs. In sunny and warm environments, we adapted wider and flatter noses, which were more efficient at inhaling hot and humid air. Along the way, the larynx would descend in the throat to accommodate another adaptation, vocal communication. The larynx works as a valve to shuttle food into the stomach and protect us from inhaling it. Every animal and every other Homo species had evolved a higher larynx located towards the top of the throat. This made sense since a high larynx functions most efficiently, allowing the body to rid itself quickly should anything get stuck in our airways. As humans developed speech, the larynx sank, opening up space in the back of the mouth and allowing a wider range of vocalizations and volumes. But this lowered larynx became less efficient at its original purpose. It created too much space at the back of the mouth and made early humans susceptible to choking. We could choke if we swallowed something too big, and we could choke on smaller objects that were swallowed too quickly or too sloppily. Sapiens would become the only animals and the only human species that could easily choke on food and die. Strangely, sadly, the same adaptations that would allow our ancestors to outwit, outmaneuver, and outlive other animals, that mastery of fire and processing food, that enormous brain and the ability to communicate in a vast range of sounds, all these things would obstruct our mouths and throats and make it harder for us to breathe. This recessed growth would, much later, make us prone to choke on our own bodies as we slept, to snore. None of this mattered to early humans, of course. For tens of thousands of years, our ancestors used these wildly developed heads to breathe just fine. Armed with a nose, a voice, and an intellect, humans took over the world. I'd been thinking about our hirsute forebears ever since I'd visited Evans months back. There they were, crouched along the rocky African shore, pulling in easy breaths through gaping nasal apertures and chomping on braised rabbit with perfect teeth. And here I am, slack-jawed under an LED light, staring at a Wikipedia page on my phone, chewing bits of a low-carb nutritional bar with my crooked teeth, coughing and wheezing and sucking exactly no air through my obstructed nose. It's evening on the second day of the Stanford mouth-breathing experiment, and I'm in bed with silicone plugs jammed inside of my nostrils, covered with tape. For the past few nights, I've been splayed out in a part of my house usually reserved for relatives or friends. But I had a feeling that my mouth-breathing lifestyle might be a challenge for my wife. Lying here, tossing and turning, thinking about cavemen and unable to sleep, I'm happy I moved. I've got a pulse oximeter device about the size of a matchbook strapped to my wrist and a glowing red wire around my middle finger. Every few seconds, the device records my heart rate and blood oxygen levels and uses this information to assess how often and how severely my tongue might get lodged in my too small mouth and cause me to hold my breath, a condition more commonly known as sleep apnea. To gauge the severity of my snoring and apnea, I've downloaded a phone app that records a constant stream of audio throughout the night, then provides a minute-to-minute graph of my breathing health every morning. A security camera just above the bed monitors every movement. Inflammation in the throat and polyps both contribute to snoring and sleep apnea. Nasal obstruction triggers this nighttime choking as well, but nobody knows how quickly the damage comes on, or how severe it might become, because until now, nobody has tested it. Last night, in my first run of plugged-up sleeping, my snoring increased by 1,300% to 75 minutes throughout the night. Olson's numbers were even worse. He went from 0 to 4 hours. I'd also suffered a fourfold increase in sleep apnea events, all this in just 24 hours. Now, lying here again, no matter how I try to relax and submit to this experiment, it's a challenge. Every 3.3 seconds, another blast of unfiltered, unmoistened, and unheated air enters through my mouth, drying my tongue, irritating my throat, and pissing off my lungs. And I've got 175,000 more breaths to go.